This word mindfulness, I hear, has some popularity right now. It is the word used for the seventh of the limbs of the Buddha's path. We're in the contemplative or the meditative limbs, effort, mindfulness, and concentration. And mindfulness is the old British translation of the Pali word sati, which in Sanskrit is smriti. And sati or smriti literally is the word for memory or remembering. And it becomes mindfulness as a quality if we use the word mind as a verb, essentially, the way that the British may well have meant it, as in mind the gap in the subway. Right? Mind your manners. To mind something is both to pay attention to it, to notice it, and there are things that should be noticed, right? Don't slip into the gap, so you're paying attention to something that might trip you up. Mind your manners is a social ethic, right? Pay attention to your behavior in a certain way. So mindfulness as the quality behind the verb to mind something. But memory is a slightly different quality. We always think of memory as referring to, like, thinking about the past in some way. And I've chewed a lot on why memory was the word the Buddha used for this particular attentional quality, an aspect of awareness, how we direct our awareness. And part of the sense I get from commentaries and teachers and my own reflection is that when I'm having a memory, I've thought about this. I'm like, okay, remember something. It's like, well, okay, I'm thinking about the time that da-da-da-da, whatever. Right? What's happening then is that appearing in my awareness in the form of image, often, sometimes words, very often image and the sort of the flavor or trace of other senses is a moment, essentially, a snapshot of a moment or a sequence of moments. Memory, then, if we let go of the concept, the past, as a fixed concept, memory as an experience is that a moment is brought to mind, or a moment in our life appears on the screen of the mind. And where mind here essentially means in the field of my attention. And so what is happening then, in a certain way, is that rather than being in the analysis or discussion internally about something, I am seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, contacting, feeling that moment. And in a certain way, it's not that different when it's a moment that was yesterday or a moment that's right now. The moments that are right now are more vivid. But if I think about yesterday where I was, okay, I'm in this room with this person, or I'm walking on this street, what happens is that the visual image of where I am right now gets kind of interrupted by a flash of the visual image of where I was. I see Telegraph Street, or I see my little office, or I see my baby running across the floor. And so I think that one of the things that early Buddhist writers, and perhaps the Buddha himself, meant with this word being this quality of attention is that my attention blossoms into or with a set of sensory experiences. And that it's actually the same quality, whether it's happening in relation to a memory of yesterday or something that's happening right here and now. Then, in the texts that describe mindfulness, mindfulness is very often conjoined with another term that has not gotten so popular in the, you know, your inner life 2.0 kind of world. And that term is sampajana, full or complete comprehension or understanding. Sam means total or complete. Jhana, it's N with tildes, is a version of jnana or knowledge. So full knowledge, it's usually translated as clear comprehension. So then the full phrase that we would kind of hyphenate in a certain way is mindfulness and clear comprehension. So then if mindfulness is this direct quality of sensory input appearing on the screen of the mind or of the attention, attention connecting with sensory material, clear comprehension is to be not in delusion or denial or error about what that is. And I think it's the clear comprehension that makes the distinction between being mindful of what's happening here and now and being mindful or remembering what happened yesterday, is simply that I understand clearly which is which. And that may seem obvious, right? You're like, hello, I'm not insane. Like, I know when I'm remembering myself at 10 years old and when I am connecting with myself here and now. That's true, you do. Maybe. Because in a certain way, the very definition of trauma is that sensory input from the past that had a certain effect on my being, especially that which scared or frightened or threatened me, in sometimes in very, very real ways. The effect of that experience is still with me. In other words, when I feel myself suddenly afraid, and I don't know really why, one of the things that's happening is that my system has gotten triggered into remembering something that happened or the effect, the trace of something that happened maybe a long time. I might not even know what the original impulse was, but the effect is still here. If I notice it, that's mindfulness. I'm aware, oh look, I'm startled, I've become frightened, or I can feel my heart racing. If I don't have that second quality of clear comprehension, it's much more likely that I'm going to get lost in trying to explain to myself what's happening. Oh, I don't like the food at this restaurant. You know, oh, I'm upset because of the election. Both might be true, but they might not be the actual cause of the feeling I'm having. And if I dig in, what I might find is, oh, I know what this is. I can feel how this has deep roots in me. And part of what I'm doing is I'm teasing out what's present and what was past. And completely central to trauma resolution and many kinds of therapy is understanding in a very non-cognitive, in a very physical, deep, animal kind of way, what is present and what is past. And this is at the heart of the healing process that Buddhist contemplative practice points toward. So mindfulness says, bring to mind, or bring into your activity in this moment the quality called remembering, or memory, or mindfulness. Sati, memory, recollection, remember. So we could translate that as, okay, first step, remember where you are. So in the meditation, I talked about a way of beginning meditation practice where I start with my eyes open, my senses open, and I start by sensing where I am on the planet. I feel my body in the sitting posture. I know what my cushions are. I know where I am on the floor. I know who's here in the room with me and what room I'm in and what building I'm in and what street I'm on and what city I'm in. And I kind of go outward in rings like that until I have a sense that I'm right here. This is partly a way to ground myself so that I'm not still spinning in the work of the day. It's also, in a deeper way, a way to orient myself to actually being where I am, rather than spinning in memory of what's not happening, right? Being here, but actually still being at work. Being here, but actually still being in a difficult conversation I had yesterday. Being physically here, but actually still being frightened as a 10-year-old. With this as a basic practice, mindfulness becomes both a healing practice and a concentration practice when we start to have some facility in doing this. In other words, in our meditation, and this is just practice for throughout our whole day, part of what some part of our attention can be doing is saying to ourselves, hey, where am I right now? Like, oh, I'm not actually still there, I'm here. And then the mind goes off. It's like, yeah, but you know, the trolls are attacking Colbert, but really they just want to, and I'm like, no, that was yesterday. And, you know, this is today. Right? And I could be like, but it's great, like, you know, like the centrist won in France. And I could be like, that was yesterday. Today the election was in Korea. You know, like whatever your lens is. I'm listening to the news too much. But, again, mindfulness says, oh, listening to the news was this afternoon at 3. It's not happening now. And so what I want to notice is not just that the mind wandered. Often when we get basic meditation instructions, they treat the mind wandering like it's a puppy. That's a classic instruction. There's a puppy. It goes after every sense impression. You have to train it to stay here. It's a good metaphor. Except that the puppy of your mind is not a puppy, first of all. Maybe that's a good start. Your mind is not a puppy. The reason your mind is not a puppy is that a puppy is an innocent animal who has not been profoundly harmed by the world, hopefully, right? And if they have, they are still not you. And the way that you've been harmed is not the same way that puppies get harmed, and your response is different. What this means a little bit is that the metaphor of the puppy suggests that the mind's wandering is random and innocent. It is innocent in terms of, like, there's no blame on the mind wandering. But it's not random. It's karmically conditioned. And that's the classic Buddhist way of saying our experience absolutely comes from what has happened before. And the mind does not wander to random places. It goes where it is drawn to for very specific reasons. When I started meditating, I realized very quickly that I could not concentrate. My mind wandered all the time. And my favorite wander, so my early practice was in Zen. The instruction was just sit there, maintain the posture. Not much other instruction was given, but at some point I figured out that it was useful to try to follow the breath. I was terrible at it. And what I would do is I would sit there thinking about stuff, anything, really. I talked myself through the Lord of the Rings several times over, etc., you know, the good things. And at some point, I settled into a deep groove where every time I sat, I would come back to designing the perfect little house for myself. And I just built that house over and over and over. And I redesigned it, and I moved the rooms around, and I did all these things, and at different points, I was like, wow, I really like designing little houses. But I was not mindful of it. In other words, I didn't recognize what was happening. I didn't have clear comprehension. All I was doing was spending my time, you know, making shoji screens and well, I was a Japanese Zen, so I'm like, you know, beautifully planed wooden floors and polished, everything was wood and little squares and, you know, it was some combination of Japanese Orientalism and the sort of Berkeley 1920s craftsman movement, right? Green Gulch, essentially, was my heaven realm, if you know it. So I was a bourgeois Orientalist at 24. I got over it. Took a while. But only much, much later did I develop enough clear comprehension and enough curiosity about my own process to become mindful of what I was doing and to be like, what was going on with that? And I settled into it, and I thought about the house. And I was like, oh, right. I didn't even notice that through that whole period of my life, like, I was completely unstable. I was hitchhiking around the country, sleeping in train stations, mostly just trying to have sex with anyone who would have me, failing, generally, and ending up in flipping in and out of monastery, performance art, monastery, grad school, dropout, monastery. That was sort of my scene. And it never occurred to me that, like, I was this completely flailing mid-20-something, like, ungrounded mess. And what I found was the most hardcore disciplined Buddhist practice in the country. And all I did was sit there designing houses. And when I finally sort of noticed that, I was like, you know, a little, like, facepalm. Like, oh, that's what I was doing. Clear comprehension arose, and I was like, oh, that wasn't just a random fantasy. That was the fantasy expression of a feeling. And this, I think, is almost the most important thing I want to point us to with mindfulness, is that mindfulness, for many of us who are not doing, like, either focused concentration practice on retreat or kind of intense full-time practice, those of us in ordinary lay life, the mindfulness that we often get recommended to do is mindfulness of ordinary activities. Notice yourself washing the dishes, notice yourself walking along the street, feel your feet on the floor, sit in meditation, feel your breath. Those are all good practices, right? So no shade on the mindfulness instructions. But that's not actually what most of us spend most of our attention engaged with. What most of us spend most of our attention engaged with is feelings and the stories behind them. Relationships, challenges, things that are happening on the narrative level or the interpersonal level or the sociopolitical level or the physical energetic level of our lives. And if our longing in taking up a practice like mindfulness is to decrease stress and anxiety as a start, and then maybe to move toward profound liberation if we're engaging in a Buddhist version of mindfulness, then the practices of becoming mindful of momentary sensory information, exactly what I'm seeing, exactly what I'm smelling, exactly what my hands are touching, that, in a sense, almost is like the thing to aspire toward. I start to think that it's often taught that that's like a basic practice, that's your beginner's practice, is become aware of those things. And sometimes I think that's awesome, and I think for some people that's a really good beginner's practice. Part of what it does is it interrupts the stream of your obsessive thinking and it makes you focus on things that are direct and present and material and real, right? My foot feels like this. The air is a little cool, which is pleasurable because it's usually unpleasantly hot, etc. But for many folks that I've worked with, including myself, that basic instruction to become aware of ordinary moment-to-moment material things as they happened is virtually impossible. And for me, it was virtually, I heard that basic instruction 10,000 times before I realized that I sucked at it. And at that point, I was a senior student in my tradition, and I couldn't really tell anybody that I sucked at it, because like, I was getting all this respect and shit, and like, what am I going to say? Like, oh, I can't even do the most basic instruction. What I realized was, oh, I can't do it because for me it's not the most basic instruction. That the basic instruction was, what's actually happening right now for you? And what was actually happening was worry, anxiety, fantasy, tons of piles of fantasy. Do you get the difference, right? The thing that's usually taught as the basic instruction assumes that you are able to interrupt your fantasy or your anxiety and stay with this basic thing. That requires concentration, stability, and safety, the sense of safety. Because if what the mind is doing in spinning all those fantasies, like, oh, I'm going to build this perfect house, what it's doing is it's coming up with a fantasy of safety and groundedness to make up for the fact that there was none, or not as much as was needed, in my ordinary life. I was unable to come out of that fantasy into mindfulness of ordinary things, because my body, I would say, was not so easily convinced. I might be like, what's happening right now? I'm seeing the pine tree, I'm feeling the gravel under my feet. And somewhere in me was going like, that's not important, I'm under threat. I must keep trying to make things safe. So this is a proposal that for some folks, a good beginning mindfulness instruction is not feel your feet, connect with exactly what's happening through your senses, but just tell yourself in a direct way what's happening. Just notice what's already here. Oh, I feel like shit. Excellent. Good mindfulness. What flavor of shit? The oh my God, I'm not going to be able to make a living, I'm going to end up living on the street flavor. It's like, oh, that one, that hurts. Yeah, cool. So you notice the flavor and that it hurts and what it is. Like, yes, I'm like, excellent, perfect mindfulness. Right. There's no fixing in mindfulness. That's another quality. For fixing the material world, we rewind the path and go back to speech, action, livelihood, right? The whole ethical part we just talked about. So this is a little bit of a rebuttal to kind of, you know, the standard kind of model of mindfulness that's out there. And I might be jumping a few steps for a few of you all if you're not familiar with it. If mindfulness is relatively new to you, mindfulness is generally taught like this. Become aware of what's happening right now in a non-judgmental, continuous way. Some people add, with kindness, etc. It's good. Be nice to yourself and others. But again, that's the ethical practice. We already did that, right? Like, yeah, that should be already there. But indeed, do it. And then we can add to that, basically, like, be aware of what's happening while it's happening. That's the basic mindfulness instruction. The idea with that instruction, again, is that it interrupts the stream of habit and confusion, and it brings you into the present. What's good about the present? One of the main things that's good about it is that it's what's happening. And so it's more useful to connect with than what's not happening. From a trauma perspective, the present is mostly not a moment of life threat. And if it is, then you don't need to be mindful. If you're being life threatened, the thing you need to do is do what your impulses are telling you to do, which is run or fight back or shut down. Yeah, fight, flight, and freeze are the appropriate response to life threat. And taking time out to be aware of them is not a good use of your energy.
It's not possible.
And it's not possible. Yeah, absolutely. Right. Those forces, they take over. Mindfulness can be cultivated as a habit that, for instance, as soon as you get your wits about you, mindfulness swings back in and says, oh my God, look what just happened, right? But it comes in as memory of that thing. So mindfulness is mindfulness of the moment that is not a moment of life threat. Therefore, there's the possibility of mindfulness alerting us to the fact that we are safer in this moment. And maybe safer than we think we are. Again, that's the haunting that is trauma. And by trauma, I mean painful karma, painful past conditions of any kind, mild or extreme. Is in this moment, I'm feeling the effects of something that is not actually happening. And I'm feeling that because I've been conditioned to do so. The process of being mindful of this moment over and over and over is part of deconditioning, of unbinding myself from that momentum. More and more, I think of the Buddha's path as a path out of trauma. If trauma is another word for dukkha or suffering, if we heal a trauma, what happens is that the symptoms no longer trouble us, right? The past becomes past. What if everything painful that happened we could do that with? It would simply become something painful happened, which is just reality, and it's now past. That would be a profound healing and letting go of the past. What if we then did the same thing with all of the pleasures of the past? As in, that was pleasurable, it's now not happening. It's the nature of reality to sometimes be pleasurable, but grasping onto a past pleasure will not make it reappear. Therefore, I'm suffering if I do so. It's a kind of trauma itself, to use the word differently. The past has hooked me. What if I can heal from my past pleasures also? No longer needing to hold on to them because they are truly past. And if the entire past, every moment of pain and pleasure, was healed, meaning let go of, and then to speak in classical Buddhist language, not just from this lifetime, but for all previous lifetimes, forever, what would remain? What would this moment be like if there was no trace of the past left? What would mindfulness or memory remember if the symptoms of the past pains and pleasures were no longer here, influencing me in the present? Mindfulness would have no distraction to hook onto. And the sense in the texts and in the practice of the senior students now and in the past, is that when that much letting go has happened, the mind very naturally and out of delight in existing, essentially, that's not really a Buddhist way of saying it, but it's pleasurable, simply settles. And that settling goes through lots of layers, of course, because there's a lot of letting go to happen. But that settling, when there's less and less to cling to or holding on to me, mindfulness becomes very pure, very bright. It says a light opens internally. In Patanjali's Yoga Sutra, which essentially describes this exact same thing, the verse says, the veil is lifted from the mind's luminosity. In the Buddhist system, the appearance of light is called the mark. The mark of concentration, the mark of profound letting go, the sign. It's not that you have to see inner lights or anything literal like that. But in the same way that when we fully arrive in this place, even our ordinary vision gets a little bit less foggy, a little bit less vague, and the colors and the light that's here shines forth a little more brightly. You can do it in a moment. Right? Come fully out of distraction and into the body that's here and now, and all the senses brighten a little bit. This is the mark of presence. When we do this, and there's nothing from the past holding us, it says mindfulness gets perfected. And the perfection of mindfulness has the quality called equanimity. Neither pleasant nor painful, and absolutely non-reactive. Equanimity is always both a heart quality and a wisdom quality. And the wisdom quality is what I'm kind of pointing toward tonight particularly. The past is done. The future has not arrived. And the present is constantly changing. What is there to grasp onto? So the perfection of mindfulness sees clearly this. So the pathway there is to be, is to remember, to be aware of, with clear understanding, exactly what is here and now. And the doorway to that can be through feeling, through intense feeling, or if there's concentration and enough perception of stability, you can go right to the simple, immediate, material reality of the body in this posture, the arm moving, the image of the clock, the sound. And then what all we're asked to do from there is to do that again in the next moment, and then again. So mindfulness turns out to be very, very simple. The challenge is to break the habit of forgetting to do it. Yeah? And so again, remember, remember. So, thanks for that, for your clear and kind attention, and your thoughts on mindfulness practice in general, any aspect of it from your own practice. Yes, here.
So, I think most people start with having a hard time fixing their mind on the present and what's happening, right? And yep. You were saying, yeah, there's a group of people that just like aren't going to do that as their introduction. It's not the appropriate introduction to mindfulness.
I think so.
So how do you discern those two categories of people if you're a teacher of mindfulness?
Yeah, right? It's a good question. I'm proposing something that that's a little bit radical in the mindfulness world, which is that the beginner instructions aren't good for everybody, and that... And then, Sierra, you're asking that as a teacher of mindfulness instructions, how do you tell? Essentially, what instructions are going to be good for what people? And unfortunately, because mindfulness is often taught as if it's the same thing as meditation, like we focus on sitting still and closing the eyes or being inward, you can't tell. Because... Right? Everyone looks good, sitting still. Right? But you can look for signs, and the signs essentially are both, in a sense, the physiological signs of non-settling, and then verbal report. You can ask people, you know, what it's like.
So if somebody's like constantly fidgeting, which I have had,
yeah.
And do you think think it's appropriate if you like continue to see the constant fidget is to move to shift in the moment your instruction to something like notice that you're like notice what's present for you if you're fidgeting or notice like not so much like
yeah.
I mean, that's still a present moment physical experience, but...
It is. I will often adjust my instructions depending on what people are doing in the room.
Right.
I won't say notice yourself fidgeting, first of all, because it's a negative noticing, generally, if we are implying that it's better to be still, mm-hmm. which is itself an ideology. Mm-hmm. And not everyone can be still, mm-hmm. right? And it's, in a certain way, all of the markers that popular mindfulness has taken to be positives can be correlated to sociocultural privileges also, right? So some folks don't have the either the kind of health and well-being or ability to be still, either physically or neurologically. And many folks may not have the, it might not be the right environment for instance, someone to close their eyes and be still in. So that's a whole nother conversation, of course. But I might say something like, also never wanting to single out a specific person, I might say something like, you know, at this point in sitting, you may be experiencing kind of aches or pains in the body. You may find yourself restless and wanting to move or feeling really dull and sleepy, and all of this is really natural. And what you can do is just to notice the impulses. Notice the feeling. Notice if you feel restless and jittery. Notice if you feel dull and sleepy. I'll kind of just toss it in as a general mm-hmm. instruction. Trying to make it broad enough, specific enough to include the person that was the trigger for my saying it, but broad enough to kind of scoop in a bunch of other folks who are undoubtedly also not just concentrating on their breath. Beyond that, it's a deeper conversation that for me essentially goes to the point where I don't consider like breath concentration, mindfulness of breathing, say, to be a beginner's practice, and I wouldn't teach it in a group that I didn't know had some stability already. And so I disagree enough with the standard model that I just don't do it, you know. Part of what we do in here, especially when I give beginner's instructions, is I essentially start with basic both physical orientation, right? Eyes open, see the room, let your eyes move around. See the circle of people. See what it feels like to be here. Notice that you've come from a busy day and you might feel those energies. And kind of just do whatever it takes to land here and see what that's like. And that's my beginning instruction. Mm-hmm. Rather than, you know, because... I actually almost don't even want to say, like, some people don't do well with the basic instructions. I almost would rather flip it and say... It's the rare person in contemporary culture that can take a basic instruction like bring your attention to the breath at the nose tip and stay there in a continuous way. You know, and when the mind wanders, bring it right back. Most people I know, 10 years for that instruction to really take. And that's like including retreats and serious practice. I don't know that many people that can do that. Which means that what we're doing is we're giving the basic instruction as a framework. I think it's a wholesome framework. But that what people are mostly doing is they're processing their emotions and thinking about their relationships and their work. And they're coming back. And they're learning about themselves in doing that. But I wonder if that's the best frame for doing that. Mm-hmm. And where actually maybe it would be better to be like, okay, let's get into pairs and sit together. And for 5 minutes, each person's going to do a little monologue and say what's on their mind and what they're feeling. And the other person's just going to listen with love, right? Mm-hmm. And the person's going to be like, I'm worried about my relationship, and I'm worried about my job, and then my hip aches. but it's really nice to be here with you, and you seem really nice, and I like you so much. Just sitting across from me, that feels so lovely, and it's just so nice to just be able to say something to someone and have them listen. And I'm like, that's the foundational frame, I think, that lots of people would benefit by. So then, after a lot of mindfulness stuff, I've changed my teaching in this direction. So,
well, thank you.
Yeah, so that's a start for that. Thank you for asking. Yeah, Andy.
On that note, I wonder, like, what, because you said, like, another frame would be to divide up into pairs and stuff.
Yeah.
But also, like, individual daily practice is so useful.
It is.
So, like, what's the structure for working in that kind of way alone?
Yeah. Right, how do you do that just in your own daily practice?
Like, in a really intentional way, not like, I'm trying to breathe, but I gotta do all this stuff.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Part of what I think about is that it's valuable. I think we talked about this a few weeks ago. Was it you? Maybe. Yeah. About decentering the physical practice of sitting in stillness. Taking out the assumption that that's the important thing. That what I have to do. I'm not sure if it was you, but...
I don't think so.
No. It was... We were talking about... Or I'll just... Back to the present. I was referencing this thing. I was like, what? That seemed to make sense. If I go in the direction that I was speaking about tonight, that the important thing in mindfulness is actually to tune into not just kind of something that's happening now, like I'm seeing you, but to tune into essentially activation, right? Or distress, like what's actually happening to affect my experience strongly. Pleasures and pains, then what I might want to do, let's say, still in the context of, let's say, a ritual morning practice, right, which sitting is, what if I make my space, and I get into it, and maybe I sit down, you know, I like sort of, I do my thing, and then I don't begin a method right away. I don't, like, try to go inwards to my breath, but I kind of just, like, first of all, orient. Orienting first is always nice. I see where I am. I see my little altar if I have one. I feel myself. And I might be like, okay, how's it going this morning? You know, I'd be like, how am I doing? And it's useful for me to have a few things that I check in with. So I check in with physical energy, right? Sleepy or restless. I check in with mental concentration or clarity, like scattered or focused. And I check in with kind of emotional tone, tilting pleasant or tilting unpleasant. Those three things, and there could be others for you, but those three for me are like a nice, basic, contained check-in. And as I have a sense of those, going off of what we talked about last time for wise effort, I'm going to see where I'm at on the spectrum of, like, are there wholesome qualities present? And I'm going to see what would be useful to upregulate the wholesome qualities and downregulate the unwholesome. So I check in and I notice that I'm, like, fidgety and restless, like your example. And then I might be like, okay, what do you do with fidgety restlessness? It's like, well, I can do disciplined sitting and kind of just, like, frame the restlessness within stillness. That's one way. I could get up and do some asana, some yoga practice, and move the energy, if I know that that works for me. I could sit but not be really still, but kind of go with it and do some undulating and deeper breathing and kind of move some energy. Or I could ignore it and do something else entirely and just let it process by itself. But I can make my practice essentially be like the framework of being there. Let's say I'm going to be here for half an hour, and my goal is not to sit in meditation per se, but to rest into as wholesome qualities I can, to invoke and maintain wholesome qualities, with the goal perhaps of settling into stillness. But let's say meditation is the, like, meditation in quotation marks, inwardness in the sitting posture where I'm tracking the breath and settling the mind. What if that's the end point rather than the method for getting there? What if that's actually the thing that I want is to feel settled and concentrated? So rather than assuming that I can get to feeling settled and concentrated by sitting and trying to get settled and concentrated, I might open to a menu of things that I can do that I have the sense alter my state essentially in that direction. And so sometimes it's going to be I need to be more active, sometimes I need to be much more passive or receptive, sometimes I'm going to need to do things, sometimes I'm going to need to do less. Yeah? So you have a menu, and you order skillfully off the menu, and you know what you're headed for, would be one method. Yeah? And if that's too wide open, one of the ways you can contain it is through time, right? You just like, I'm going to be in this ritual space for 30 minutes, right? Or until the incense burns down, you know? And whatever happens in that space is okay, you know, but I'm just working with it, going along. I journal, I draw, I, you know, whatever. Yeah? Yeah. So that's one way where you're just unbinding morning, your practice from the method of sitting and opening to, like, you know, by all means necessary.
Yeah, I think I kind of had a sense of that, but then it's like, at a certain point, it's like you just have to try so much stuff.
You do. Yeah. You do. Yeah.
It's like, because you don't know at first.
And of course, you have to try any given thing 3 dozen times before you have a sense of what it does. Mm-hmm. That's okay. Yeah. You know? there's no rush, you know? One of my teachers was like, yeah, you know, I wanted to know if this particular practice was would be useful for me. So I committed to doing it for 5 years. Yeah? Yeah. So, you know, and then I assessed, is it working? So,
yikes.
Yeah, seriously. Right? Right? No worries, right? Like, you know, Lisa.
I'm wondering if what you were saying was like, for instance, okay, so I'm deciding to sit down and pay attention to my breathing, but I'm noticing that I'm failing at that because I'm thinking about this, that, and the other thing. So mindfulness is noticing what's happening. So instead of, I've got to pay attention to the breath, notice what's happening with my mind and look at that. And maybe starting by trying to pay attention to the breath will you'll make it. It seems to me then I can notice my mind more than if I don't.
It, for sure.
But it, not hold it there and maybe notice. Oh, I'm thinking about work and notice that, and rather than saying oh, thinking going back to the breath, just be mindful of that and learn something from it.
Learn something from it, not in a cognitive way. Like, don't continue to think about work and try to understand work, right? That's not being mindful. What you do is you notice it, oh, look, I'm thinking about work again. And then you're like, what's up? And you drop into the body, and you feel it. You're like, oh, I'm worried. Like, there's always a feeling.
Okay.
The feeling is more important than the story.
Right. So the feeling is more what's really happening.
They're both really happening, but it's a little bit like saying, you know, if you really want to understand a river, you're not going to get it from tracking the little flickering bubbles on the surface. You have to sense like where the whole stream is going, and the feeling is deeper than the story. Mm-hmm. So the story is bubbling around, doing its thing. The story is always a little different, right? Something happened yesterday. Something happened this morning.
Yeah.
But the feeling is a much bigger current in my life, especially when the feeling is connected to ancient material, which we would call
trauma. So both of them are sati, both of them are remembering, but you're saying that this would be more skillful.
I think it's more skillful for most most lay people not on retreat. The practice of just noting a thought and coming right back to the breath is a concentration practice.
Right, that's concentration rather than
that's concentration. That's not, it's a version of mindfulness. That's mindfulness of one object. And what I'm proposing essentially is that without a lot of training and retreat conditions, most folks in ordinary life are not immediately good at concentration. There's too much going on. And trying to do classical concentration practice right away works well for a very tiny percentage of people. But concentration practice has become the standard beginning mindfulness instruction. This is right. Partly Goenka's fault. This is Goenka's fault. Goenka was like, you come on retreat, and you just do intense nose-tip concentration for 3 days, and then that's enough. You have all sorts of concentration now, and now you do, like, body-sweeping vipassana. But who's actually doing that? We're all worried about work and our relationships and fantasizing and doing that, except for, like, you know, two folks up in the front who are like, right? I'm being a little bit forceful about this distinction between people, partly because I just wrote a 400-page dissertation on it. And I ended up using the term neuroprivilege, which I borrowed from the autism people, to speak about the innate skill at concentration that some people have, right? We're both musicians. You were a much more talented musician than I. As it goes. And it's not a problem, right? It would be the same thing as saying, you know, I had the gene to be a really fast runner. It's nobody's virtue to be good at something. It's karma, right? It's biology. It just happened. It just happened that with the same amount of practice, you were way better than some folks with that amount of practice from really early on. And it's just like that, right? Some folks hear the concentration instructions and bang,
right.
Can do them.
Yeah.
I was not like that, right?
Yeah.
It's just like that. And so rather than try endlessly to match up to this thing, mm-hmm. I would rather we find the channel that's least blocked for each of us and initially cultivate that. And I think for a lot of us, because our impulses so strongly trend toward feeling and the relational and story, becoming aware of the energies and feelings behind that channel is more apparent. It's just like, how are you doing? I feel good, right? Mm-hmm. I feel bad. That's the channel I want to start with in mindfulness because it's immediately apparent. Rather than being like, how are you doing? I don't know, wait, let me find the breath. Right? It's a little artificial.
Can it then lead to more ability to concentrate?
Of course. They're not separate, right? If you learn to focus, everything
upregulates. You're just focusing on something that's more available to you.
Yeah. 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 Okay. Yeah. No, first, notice what you can. Then start to shape that wise effort, right? And eventually notice what's more and more helpful along the path, mm-hmm. right? But the first doorway is notice anything. last bit here.
That's it. It kind of leads to, because I was worried that my question wouldn't connect, but I think it kind of leads to So when you were talking about kind of the karmic forces of like the trauma that are leading into your experience, I feel like I've been experiencing that a lot with envy, which is something for a long time that I've just noticed about myself. And then like recently it came to a point where I was like, hey, noticing isn't enough anymore. Like it's, and it's been one of the challenges for me is like this balance between accepting this part of myself and like everything that has led up to it, but not accepting it, like drawing the line in a certain way, and like that's been really challenging, and I've been struggling with a lot of like, should I feel? You know, like at times it's like I feel ashamed, but it's like, no, but I want to accept it, but not accept it. And like, how do I work with all that? And so I'm just kind of curious what you have to say about that. Like,
Just talk. Accept is a funny task. oh, I should accept this thing that's happening. I start with, don't worry about accept, but know that it's happening and feel it. In a way, to feel it is to accept it, right? Because what we mean by accept isn't approve of, right, or not do anything about. It really just means don't be in denial about its existence, right? So as soon as you're aware of it, you're like, oh, this thing, I'm aware of it present, this feeling, and I'm aware that it's been present in the past, so that I have a kind of momentum with this feeling. Acceptance in a certain way is to say, this is true. This is what's happening, right? And not to try to kind of squirm out of it. So when you feel it, when you're like, okay, this is that thing, and I'm not trying to be like, name it, come back to the breath, and I'm not trying to be like, name it and let it go. Go, 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 go away. I see you, go away, right? But to just be like, this is here. This is actually what's just true. Feeling the feeling and accepting it are essentially the same thing. So then the pathway is feel it. And as you feel it, what you're going to do, this is the hinge of the whole thing, is feeling it with in detail and not getting caught in the story of it has the potential to show you, if you really, this is the clear comprehension part, really understand it. It's not the same feeling as you felt last week or last month or in 1992, if you were alive then. You were. I think.
Yeah.
You know, you're young and all. But I've been teaching university, you know, it's like, oh my God, you people, you're so young. The thing I want to feel is not just like, oh, this is that feeling, but also to notice, like, it's changing all the time. It's not actually exactly the same feeling. Mm-hmm. And if I do that, then I'm feeling it, and it's already letting go. It's already shifting, right? Because there's feeling it and being lost. There's feeling it and knowing it. There's feeling it and understanding it. There's feeling it and watching it shift. And all of those are different. And as I feel something, again, there's an activation in it. There's some vibration in it. When we connect with any activation in a place essentially of being safe, right? So it's not being re-triggered. And I'm not re-triggering it with the story. The only thing it will generally do is subside. Because in the absence of further trigger, there's no reason for it to persist, right? Strong feelings subside in a minute or two if we don't re-trigger them with thought, usually, or other people. So this is why the practice is often, you know, a solitary practice, but at the very least, it's a practice of letting go of further stimulus. So notice it. The standard mnemonic is RAIN. Recognize, accept, investigate. Don't identify. Mm-hmm. In a certain way, we can say notice, feel, hang out. Notice, feel, hang out, watch it change. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Cool.
I know it's going to
further. What was that?
Notice, feel, hang out.
Yeah, you know, it doesn't have quite the same ring as RAIN. But I've run into trouble with non-identification with students. It's a hint toward a very deep Buddhist doctrine that you don't own your feelings, that they're just part of the karmic unfolding. But a lot of folks, it's an insight, not a teaching in a certain way. And I've had folks be really triggered by that part. Partly because it's jumping ahead. It's actually more healing to own your feelings first, right? So recognize, accept, investigate. Just kind of hang out there with Ray. Non-identification will happen over time anyway, as you see things arise and pass. You don't have to try to not identify with things. and a little bit like the mindfulness version, I think it's not actually helpful to kind of say, like, this is not me. That's a very classical instruction. We chant it in the monastic chanting. This is not me. This is not mine. This is not myself. But it's a little fierce for most of us who have a lot of emotional healing to do before we get anywhere near that. So don't try this at home. Don't go home and try to disidentify with things. Thank you for your presence. It's really a pleasure to be here. I hope we'll stop for tonight. Next week we'll either go on talking about mindfulness because there's more, or we'll go into samadhi. We'll just go into samadhi next week. Yeah, totally. The perfection of mindfulness. Your generosity of your presence, your money for others to be able to come, your resources as a gift for the continuation of the teachings of Dharma in this world, which is so fraught with violence and pain. Your support for the continuation of teaching like this absolutely makes it happen. So thank you for your generosity. See you next week. See you at a picnic. Take good care. Yeah.